My name's Tony Gosling. I'm a investigative journalist in Bristol, UK, who sees himself as someone who's sitting in an interesting town, which was very much involved in the so-called discovery of North America with John Cabot and the financing of that trip for the genocide of the Native American population historically, but also today. In many ways, Britain is divided, or England is anyway, into London and Bristol, the two very powerful cities. Economically, Bristol is the most expensive to live in anywhere outside London. Yeah, it's an interesting town to be doing journalism. I mean, I've been thwarted here by the local mafia a couple of times. They really don't like the stuff I do. I'm pointing out corruption within our city council, but also doing a pretty good audit, I think, on Westminster, as well as the wars in Ukraine, which the King Charles, Tampon Charlie, I call him, has been backing, and obviously the genocide in Gaza, which seems to be a very dark and deep Armageddonist style plan in order to try and start some massive war with Netanyahu and Charles in cahoots. But anyway, John, over to you.
My name is John Bosnich, and I'm speaking to you from my hometown, Fredericton, New Brunswick, in eastern Canada, and I'm trying to research the current Prime Minister of Canada, who was parachuted into office without an election, and he's trying now to get a mandate to continue the politics of the Liberal Party.
You say he's parachuted in, but actually Carney was the boss of the Bank of Canada for many years, wasn't he? He's not been parachuted into Canada at all, and he is, in fact, a Canadian.
In fact, he is. But when I say parachuted in, he was parachuted into the prime minister's seat without an election. So I think what we've got here is a bait and switch doubled operation. Carney worked here in Canada as the governor of the Bank of Canada during our crisis here, the so-called crisis of 2008. And then because of his apparently good performance in controlling the money supply in Canada, he left for England and became the governor of the Bank of England. In England, while serving as the governor of the Bank of England, apparently he was not much of a friend to Liz Truss, because there's a quote and a video of her online saying that he ran the presses day and night in England and apparently created inflation over there. And we're suffering from the worst inflation in our history here in Canada today. With I went to buy a small pack of Penlight batteries, AA batteries, and they cost $49. That's something that 2 decades ago would have cost less than $5. So we have a crisis here in Canada, an economic crisis. And the reason I've called you, Tony, is because you've been on the ball in England watching what's been going on, especially during the period when Mark Carney was running the Bank of England.
Well, it's great, actually, John, for you to have contacted me to try and initiate this little chit chat, because I'm usually nagging you. And one thing, very important thing to say about Carney, as you're quite rightly saying, being parachuted in without actually an election of the people. So this is just within his own Liberal Party, them deciding
Correct.
That the person that the people voted in is going to be removed and that it will be replaced by Carney. This is an internal party decision. It's nothing to do with the Canadian people. We had exactly the same thing happened here in the UK with Boris Johnson. Love him or hate him, and I can tell you, I loathe the guy. Bullingdon Club, really one of the super elite, sitting down with people like Nat Rothschild, George Osborne, a whole list of the scallywags who are told when they're at Oxford in their early 20s that they are going to be running the country, and of course he did. Is Boris Johnson was removed over Partygate, which, speaking to young people here, they all said, well, we were all partying during COVID. We were giving each other COVID because we knew that it was much better that we actually had natural immunity to this and that there was no chance of us being harmed by it. And so it's very difficult to see why the whole Partygate thing was blown out of all proportion. But anyway, he was replaced internally within the Conservative Party by a guy called Rishi Sunak from Goldman Sachs, who was a complete and utter disaster. And my contacts within the civil service trade unions here in Britain explained to me that literally from a year before the general election happened, that the Conservatives did not want to win the 2024 general election. They deliberately had somebody like Sunak, is completely incompetent, although he's very good for the city, to run the country for a while to make sure that the Labour Party had a good chance of winning. So, yeah, so that's the position, is we've got these technocratic leaders, really. Not here with Starmer. He is definitely a Labour leader, but he's part of the Trilateral Commission. But it's interesting that they're now doing in Canada, John, what it looks like they did to kick Boris out and to get Goldman Sachs Sunak in here.
Well, indeed, you're right. Trudeau had zero chance of winning a re-election. Trudeau himself was, according to my sources, was just picked up out of the blue by the financiers south of the border. Trudeau was picked up by people who wanted a pro-war leader in Canada to support NATO intervention in Ukraine. So Justin Trudeau was not intended to do politics. He was a drama student and a drama teacher. And in fact, we call him the drama queen. And he was selected by American pro-war activists who thought, wow, we can come in, talk to his mother, Margaret Trudeau, the widow of Pierre Trudeau, one of the most famous Canadian leaders, who was anti-American, anti-American ownership of Canada, and anti-war. And he was a good friend of Fidel Castro. So, amazingly enough, the Americans managed to get to Margaret Trudeau and to the Trudeau family after the intended successor, Michel Trudeau, the son of Trudeau, who was trained to be a politician, died skiing in the Rockies. Now, the story is that Michel Trudeau was smoking marijuana at the time that he died, but this has never been established. What we do know is that Trudeau openly smoked marijuana, the father, and the son legalized marijuana here in Canada in, I believe it was 2018. I may be not correct about the date, but so the son was then literally picked up by the globalist anti-Russians and placed into the prime ministership, placed into the leadership of the Liberal Party in a kind of a wave of emotion because he's the successor of the great Pierre Elliott Trudeau. He came to power. He was reelected. He stayed in power until finally his incompetence showed through to such a degree that had Justin Trudeau gone into this election against a resurgent Conservative Party, he would have lost completely. So on the orders of the powers that be behind this, the dark red curtains in the Liberal Party, Justin Trudeau was forced out. He resigned and they had to replace him. Well, the options were, get this, Chrystia Freeland, the granddaughter of a Nazi propagandist in Ukraine, that was option A, and option B was Mark Carney, the bankster from London, personal friend of King Charlie III, and personal financier of the Nazis in Ukraine. So you're damned if you do and you're damned if you don't, because we either had to stick with Trudeau, who sent Canadian forces to train Nazis who were wearing swastikas and SS tattoos on their arms in Ukraine, and who brought Nazis from Ukraine with swastika tattoos and with SS tattoos to Canada to train them. So this was Trudeau, and this is the Trudeau who was threatening to Putin until Putin shook his hand and made it clear who would beat who, because Trudeau was saying, I want to tell that Putin what to do. It's like the worst, lowest level comedy, the politics in Canada. In any event, the Liberal Party backdoor rulers, the runners of the party, kicked Trudeau out. He resigned, and they parachuted Mark Carney, former Bank of England governor, into power here. What's my theory about what's going on? Well, we've got several empires now taking shape. We've got Russia resurgent with the sales of its oil power and the redevelopment of its agricultural base. We've got Russia reclaiming the majority Russian areas of Ukraine, which were to be seized by NATO, which was financing the Orange Revolution and the attempted takeover by Zelensky of Russian-populated majority Russian regions of Ukraine to turn Ukraine into a NATO missile base right next to the heart of Russia. That was that war. That war has been turned around by Putin's final decision that he had to intervene directly and could no longer simply turn a blind eye to volunteers who were coming to support the Russians. Putin invaded Ukraine, seized control over the majority Russian territories, and that's where we are today. The English, who were behind Zelensky, and the Americans, who were behind the English in the Anglo-American Empire, and don't ever get confused there. It's not the Amero-Anglo Empire, as it would be if it were in alphabetical order. It's the Anglo-American Empire. The Anglo-imperialists teach the American grunts what to do. And so these things are all connected. And Carney was the bankster in England who was pumping up the money to finance the Nazis against Russia in Ukraine. Trudeau was doing the same. So basically, not only that, Carney was a key advisor to Trudeau even while Carney was running the Bank of England, which means that Trudeau was the smiling face, the drama queen, Prime Minister of Canada, but his economic policies were being advised and run by Carney, who has had to, like Mission Impossible, he's had to pull off the Trudeau mask off of his head and reveal that he is actually the bankster behind the Western war machine in Ukraine, the bankster behind the Canadian economy, and the bankster who went and contacted Donald Trump, and Donald Trump said, well, I think I can work with this fellow. That's a recent telephone interview between Carney and Trump.
Yeah, it may well be, of course, that Donald Trump is being put back in his box by the people that really run the world. But since I last saw you, I like these kind of little crosstalk chit chats without even Peter Lavelle involved, John. Is the fascinating situation where, having been made, let's not say elected, because he's kind of been crowned really as Liberal leader and Prime Minister, Carney then comes immediately over to see King Charles.
Of course, because that's his boss.
Right, and then he has a little chit chat with King Charles. I'm not sure if it was at Windsor, Sandringham, or wherever. And Charles, of course, has just cleaned off the dust off of the doormat because Zelensky's just left. And then he sends Carney back to Canada to announce that there's going to be a general election. So it does look as if Charlie is really kind of ruling the roost there.
Absolutely. I can add to that. Not only is Charlie 3 conferring directly with Zelensky as a part of the Anglo-imperial attack on Russia, which is what we've got happening in Ukraine, Charlie is sending his personal Bank of England governor to take over Canada. Why is that? Well, because Trump has recently been looking at Canada and thinking, wow, they've got all that hydropower. They've got all that oil. They've got all that gas. They've got all that lumber. They've got all that empty, undeveloped land. And they've got the Arctic, which could be drilled for oil, for greater amounts of oil than are already being drilled out of there. They've also got gold. There's a very active gold industry in Canada, and diamonds up in our north. And so Trump looked at us and thought, well, you know, if I'm going to cut my links with NATO, and if I'm going to have to deal with China, And if China is going to outbid me and control the Pacific, I better seize the resources of Canada. So in order to seize the resources of Canada, I've got to work with a bankster who likes me and who is supporting my position on getting to these resources. And so he is now trying to find middle ground, because Charles wants the resources of Canada because England has left the EU. England is trying to rebuild its old colonial empire. And of course, the Africans are having none of it and are kicking them out, just like the Africans are kicking out the French. So England can't make any headway in India anymore, which used to be the crown jewel of the English Empire. I call it English, not British, because in fact, it is the English who ran it and the others who tagged along. But the fight now is a resource fight, and Canada is a resource superpower. So Trump tries to get the resources. Charles III needs the resources because he's turning his back on the EU. He sends his bankster, parachutes him into power as the prime minister without any election, because the Liberal Party has to choose between a granddaughter of a Nazi propagandist and the delegate of King Charles III. Well, they went with the King Charles III candidate, given two dictates from external forces. They realized that if they put Freeland in power, that it would be exposed the degree to which Trudeau's government had been supporting Nazis in Ukraine. So she was out, and it was too obvious. The designation of Carney is one degree of separation from King Charles, and it washes a little bit better with the Canadian public. The last word is that the private enterprise CTV, Canadian Television Network, and the government-owned CBC, which is like the BBC, modeled after the BBC, are both biased in favor of the liberal globalist bankster Carney, and are doing everything they can to get him elected.
Yeah, well, you'll also find, I'm sure, with all the search engines, I'm talking about all of them, including things like DuckDuckGo. People like to think this is kind of unbiased, but it isn't. And it was a guy called Robert Epstein, I think, in the United States, that's done all the research into the way that these search engine algorithms kick in when it comes to the run-up to any election, so that if you're searching for a candidate, you will either find all bad articles about them, negative articles, or else all positive articles. And of course, this is a way of funding your search engine. So you take the money from whichever political party or strategic communications company pays you the most or bids the most, right? If you bid however many billion pounds, we will make sure that everybody that goes to Google will find terrible stuff on one candidate or another. So this is an important thing to see as well, not just the mainstream press. People think they're going onto the internet to get something independent. No longer is that true. I think it probably
absolutely
was true
correct.
up until around about maybe 9/11, maybe during the 1990s, but certainly not anymore. Anyway, look, let's just zoom right in on Carney and his past, because he's a very interesting guy. I met him in 23 at Lisbon at the Bilderberg conference as he walked past me, and I suddenly realized that's Carney's just walked past me. I called out to him, "Hey, Mark." He just carried on walking, and I said, "Don't you know your own name?" And the police then started looking at me and getting a little bit agitated, but they were okay. So having seen the guy, he has this very aloof kind of, you know, the I am far above all these people. But looking at his past, obviously Goldman Sachs is a big feature, similar, of course, to Rishi Sunak. So this is the criminal banking cartel, really. Goldman Sachs is massively, they're the main bank that comes every year to and is associated with the Bilderberg meetings, this organization that was chaired for the first 20 years from the 50s to the 70s by a former SS officer, Prince Bernhard of the Netherlands, and was designed to choose politicians for the NATO countries mainly, And so he is very much a part of that. He's one of the people who is doing the choosing, I would suggest, at those conferences. So he's also been associated because of his role at the Bank of Canada. He very quickly got his feet under the table in Basel, Switzerland, at this organization called the Bank for International Settlements, BIS, which is worth saying the Bretton Woods Conference at the end of the Second World War voted to dismantle the BIS because of its very important role in the 30s in financing Hitler. But it never happened. What happened? The BIS, which is the central banker's central bank, it does the regulations for the central banks of the world. They moved opposite Basel railway station into an anonymous office above a chocolate shop with a little buzzer that didn't even say BIS on it, but people had to know that it was there. So they disappeared from view, but they were there in Basel still. And then around about 1990, late 80s, they had a big headquarters built. Once, I suppose, most of the people that could remember their crimes from the war and had been involved in Bretton Woods had passed away. And they've got a big headquarters now in Basel. The book is called about this place and about the bank is called The Tower of Basel by Adam Labor, who's also done very, very good work on the Fourth Reich and looking at the way the Nazis decided they were going to create a financial Reich at the Red House meeting in August 1944 in Strasbourg at the Red House Hotel. And this work by Adam Labor is really, if anyone's interested in looking at this BIS, Bank for International Settlements, which is very much Carney's thing these days. So Mark Carney, when he was there, and he still is, I understand, one of the members of the bank's committees, he was part of something called the European Systemic Risk Board, the ESRB, also on the very important Global Economy Meeting. This is the place where all the central bankers all get together regularly. He's been chairing that. The Economic Consultative Committee, Global Economic Consultative Committee, GEM, also the Financial Stability Board, right, which is another very important regulator of central banks. And all of this, of course, is he was on these boards even in the run-up to when he was at the Bank of Canada in the run-up to the 2008 financial crisis. Okay, so he's one of the people who was misregulating or deregulating the global banking system that led to these massive bailouts, which took absolutely, like in the UK, it was around about £1 trillion from the public finances and put them in the hands and the pockets of the banks in the form of bailouts.
This was the biggest ripoff of public funds in history when this was done. The bailouts in England and the bailouts in America, these are incredible amounts of money at stake here. I mean, I want to ask you, Tony, if you had to rate Mark Carney on a scale of 1 being not much of a danger to 10 being an absolute danger to democracy and to free speech and to participation by the average person in the governance of the Western world, where would you put him?
Well, I'll definitely put him at 10. I don't know 10. About free speech and this 10. Sort of thing. He is one of the most dangerous people on the planet, I think, because just have a look at the fraud that was created by him in 2008, basically impoverishing billions of people around the world, particularly Europe and the United States. But the financial crisis, they called it, was a deliberate con. Gordon Brown, the British Prime Minister at the time, rather stupidly said, "I saved the world." And you can still find him on YouTube and pictures, you know, bits of film of him saying, because he thought he'd done the right thing by stopping the banks from collapsing. Now, you know, many people have argued that the people who would have suffered if those banks had collapsed were anybody with really large sums of money in those accounts. So we're talking about anyone having more than, say, 50 or 100,000 pounds. Would have lost it. But anyone below that, so your ordinary person, a saver, obviously you're not going to lose your property and you're not going to lose up to around about £100,000. But anyone with money above that is going to lose it. So he should really have let those bankrupt banks collapse at the time. And also, this would, of course, precipitated court cases where the people involved in the fraud at those banks would have been quite possibly, as has happened in Iceland, for example, have been put in jail. And so Carney was one of the key people who made sure that that didn't happen through his deregulation of the whole system, and also his role at the particularly at the Bank for International Settlements, but also, of course, in the world of international banking. He was one of the conspirators, John.
OK, so I have, because of my battle to save Bobby Fischer and get him asylum in Iceland, I have relatively good connections with people in Iceland, including bankers in Iceland, who said that they let the banks collapse up there rather than bail them out, because they realized that the banks that were collapsing were violating the law. So Iceland took a different route, collapsed the banks, caused they protected the small investors, just like Canadian law protects our investments up to $60,000 in a bank account, and let the big players take the loss. This means that Carney's role goes beyond England, it goes beyond Canada, and it probably goes beyond the United States. This is a bankster, and I use that term on purpose, at the peak of the global banking cartel.
Yeah, I totally agree. And it is a cartel. You're quite right. These meetings are secret. They're not public. The minutes are not published. Of course, you know, if you would imagine that the central banks, in other words, the national banks of the world, you would hope and expect that these are public institutions which publish their minutes publicly. But no, the Bank for International Settlements is one of the most secretive organizations on planet Earth. It has even managed to wangle with the Swiss government its own jurisdiction in Basel. So none of the Swiss police are allowed anywhere near the building. They have their own private security, which suggests to me that they are rather worried that there may be fraud going on. Of course, there is. And this is, I think, the system that we've managed to push ourselves in today, is where finance is dominating. No longer is money there to serve the needs of the population. So, in other words, the idea being that, you know, for example, money is a convenient barter tool. So everybody uses it. Everyone wants it. You need it to pay your tax for petrol, whatever, and things like that. And so it can be a great convenience, but it's been turned into a form, it seems to me, John, of slavery now.
Indeed. It seems to me now that these events are not independent of one another. The parachuting into England of Sunak, the parachuting of the bankster Carney into power in Canada, Basically, the calling of the debt by the Israel lobby in the United States on Trump to keep him quiet while Israel conducts an open, televised genocide in Gaza. Where are we headed, Tony?
Well, OK, so we're already in a fascist state in the West. The corporations, it seems to me, can do exactly what they want. They have a system of public relations, which largely seems to me to be many of our government ministers who are just literally implementing. Oh, sorry, almost forgot, didn't I? World Economic Forum, Carney, Mr. Mark Carney, one of their big players. And these policies from the World Economic Forum, from Davos in Switzerland again, that wonderful meeting every January where they know that the protesters are going to freeze to death if they try and protest. Seems to me that's the obvious reason why they have the Davos conferences right on the top of the mountains in Switzerland. So it's not a very easy place to run a protest. But these are the policies which are being implemented right across the West with the willing help and aid of people like King Charles. And I would suggest to you that there's nobody in this country that's going to stand any chance of getting anywhere near power, certainly for another few years, because the king is the kingmaker here. He makes sure that, in fact, if you look at his powers to do with the courts, His powers to do with the police, his powers to do with the government, actually appointing government ministers. But it's mainly the courts, I suppose, which is so important, that nothing in this country gets prosecuted these days without his say-so. Whereas Queen Elizabeth was quite hands-off, he is very much hands-on. And as we saw recently with the meeting of the Joint Chiefs of Staff of France and Britain at Windsor Castle, convened by King Charles, he sees himself also as the guy who's the commander-in-chief, along with the, I suppose, with the French president too, of all the nuclear forces in Europe. So he's very right. much not taking a back seat. He's very much taking a forward political role. So I guess what's happened is we're in a sort of fascist system. And actually, we're kind of going back to medieval times with some guy like this, with the amount of power he wields.
Is there anybody in England who suspects the official story about the death of Diana?
Oh, of course there are. Actually, any council estate in the country, go and chat to any woman. They'll tell you. They'll also tell you that it's very unlikely that Prince Harry was Charles's son, almost certainly Hewitt's son, who was one of Diana's lovers after she realized that Charles was having this long-term affair with Camilla Parker Bowles. So if you want to get into some of the personal stuff, you've got also the we just had the 20th wedding anniversary of Charles and Camilla, which they decided that they were going to hold over in mafia country, over in Italy, for some reason. Obviously, they don't feel comfortable having their wedding anniversary here because they're both very unpopular, actually, in the UK. And so they held that over there. But one of the things that popped up to me on the Daily Express website was a bit of a detail about their wedding. And it was quite amazing that the law in Britain says very clearly that with the royal family, anybody that causes a divorce, as Charles did by cheating on Diana, cannot remarry. And this is the legal Christian law from the Church of England. And yes. So he couldn't remarry. And so he had to go and have a civil ceremony with Camilla. And the Queen stayed away. So she only joined after the ceremony at the reception. So there was no Queen there. And so she knew what she was doing. She was keeping alongside the law and the guidelines from the Church of England. And people don't realise that there are all sorts of questions about whether Camilla and Charles's marriage is actually legal anyway.
There are so many things at stake in this election. It's almost impossible to tie all these things together. Mark Carney's wife, are you familiar with her? Mark Carney's wife is has been an activist on climate change. And is said to have been a major factor in his politicization. In other words, moving him from being a bankster only to now being an active politician and Prime Minister of Canada. The global warming narrative and the climate change narrative apparently had few people in England who were more active on that topic than Mark Carney's wife. Does that have anything to do with this? Is this something?
Well, of course. Look, of course it does. And if you've ever seen the documentary Banking Nature, which is a French documentary, I think it was made around about 2012, but it's hardly been shown once on French television. It's got an English narration version, which I noticed a couple of weeks ago had disappeared off the internet. So I put it up in as many places as I possibly could and put links to, you know, to basically beg my subscribers, my listeners to please get copies of it and put it up as many. What's happening, if you watch that documentary, you can see quite clearly there's this attempt to, number one, digitize nature and, number two, financialize nature. So because the financial system is in a bit of a state when it comes to things like traditional finance, such as industrial manufacturing, wages and all this sort of thing are falling away. The idea is that you can actually turn the whole of planet Earth into a gigantic market and actually monetize all these things like beautiful fields, for example. They can be monetized so that if someone wants to go and enjoy that beautiful field, they have to pay for it. And the same with endangered species. And so this, I think, is their agenda. I have no problem whatsoever with global warming or climate change as basic ideas. But I think what's happened is these concepts have been weaponized, accelerationized, if you want, because this concept of accelerationism, the idea is you look at a problem that there is in the world now, you know, arid parts of Africa being caused by changes in the climate. You can say, well, actually, this is man causing this. And so we have to punish man for causing these problems. And we do it like this through the market. And so that seems to me what they're doing. So I thoroughly recommend watch this and please share it amongst your friends. Banking Nature will explain a lot about why this particular solution that's been proffered by COP, by Tampon Charlie and his friends, obviously his friend over in Canada as well now, this is their preferred solution to keep us enslaved, and also not just us, but the planet, to actually put fences around everything and to say, well, this is only worth whatever for its financial value.
Tony, I wanted to ask you, what's with that nickname, Tampon Charlie? Explain that.
Oh, right. Well, I think Brits remember this, but, you know, this is going back to the Diana days. In the early 1990s, there was a leak to the Sun newspaper of a secret conversation on the phone between Princess Diana and one of her lovers. And it was a bit embarrassing. It was called the Squidgy Tapes. And this was put all over. In fact, it was played on the TV, played on the radio. And I think it was around about 1993. So this was a very embarrassing thing for Diana. It was also part of the campaign at the time against Diana by Charles and by the security services who he was working very. I mean, this is quite well known here that that Charles was abusing his position in the royal family to use the security services to spy on her. So, for example, so he could stay one step ahead right the way through the divorce proceedings and this sort of thing. And in fact, there was a program, a panorama program, an interview with Princess Diana with Martin Bashir broadcast on the BBC, which began as an investigation into the security service bugging Diana, Princess Diana, as she was at the time. And so the at the time, the there was just not long before her death that you mentioned. You asked earlier, there are two extremely good books on this. There's Noel Botham's book on Diana, and probably the most important one is by...
What's the title of that book? Noel Botham's book is called
Not sure. I think it's The Death of Diana or something. But anyway, he goes into immense detail, and I can just sort of give you a few tidbits from that. But also, he finds pretty much the same conclusions as John Morgan found in his book, How They Murdered Princess Diana. And he explains that MI6 were over in Paris, that they had high-powered motorbikes ridden by people they believe were from the Special Air Service, SAS, chasing their car, that there was some sort of device on the car to cause it to the front wheels to suddenly swerve, maybe an explosive bolt or something like that, and to make it hit the pillar really fast. But that actually Diana survived the crash. She was sitting in the back. And the evidence from the emergency services that got there first discovered that actually she wasn't in too bad a state. They actually left her to deal with people who were more seriously injured. But she was actually killed in the ambulance on the way to the St. Peter Hospital by MI6, effectively, by people working for MI6. So they didn't let her survive that ambulance journey. But anyway, going back to where we were before, which is looking at the whole situation with Tampon Charlie. So we had this in the early 90s. We had this expose of Diana, recordings being played on British television, on the radio, all very embarrassing. And some of it was bleeped, but it was obvious that it was a pretty embarrassing phone call at the Squidgy Tapes as they were getting very intimate on the phone together. Anyway, about 6 months later, another tape appeared. And I would suggest this is also possibly people within the security services that saw Charles's role in getting that out to Murdoch and the press as particularly pernicious to try and discredit Diana. which of course it did. But the recording that was released of Camilla and Charles chatting was far more embarrassing. Charles is trying to make these really terrible jokes, and he says he wanted to be a tampon stuffed up inside Camilla, and that would be his. He wanted to come back as a tampon in another life.
For a next life.
Yeah. So this shows you that this. I mean, obviously, no. It's very difficult to know how these got out there, but I would suggest to you it's pretty obvious. Somebody from the GCHQ or security services had leaked the first one of Diana, and other people who thought this was really a very low thing to do and maybe weren't great fans of Charlie decided to get their own back. And of course, it was far more embarrassing for him than it had been for Diana. So that's why I say tampon Charlie, because he wanted to be a tampon. And that was his sort of joke, chit-chatting in this intimate way with Diana. So, and also, I think there are, you know, this is a sort of nickname for him these days, round certainly where I am here in Bristol, in the one of the local papers. That's all they ever call him, Tampon Charlie.
Unbelievable. Incredible. I think we've covered a lot of material here. It's coming up towards 45 minutes. I'd like to do a little bit more research, come back to you again, and do a second half for another 45 minutes.
Well, that's fine. That's fine. But this week it's Easter week, and
yes.
So I think we, you know, our prayers should be directed towards Gaza, particularly towards the Middle East, and our thoughts as well, because this situation is absolutely out of hand. I'd love to get your thoughts, and I'll give you mine when you finish, John, about what you think is motivating Netanyahu and where this is all heading, because he does seem to be getting away with it time and time again. We had a bit brief respite when Trump first arrived on the scene. Now it's almost back to normal, and it's hardly in the news. Oh dear, 30 or 40 innocent Gazans have been killed, paramedics, nurses, journalists, and we don't really report it anymore because it's happening every day.
Well, I think there's a coordinated effort on all fronts to pull off a few coups now in this short period of time. Carney took power by being parachuted into the Liberal Party, and he very quickly called an election. The argument is that, oh, well, we had to let the people decide. But actually, they wanted to have an election as quickly as possible so that people like yourself and myself, so that we could not dig deep enough to expose Carney for who he is before a vote was taken. Because once he's had the vote, he's in power for the next 5 years. So there's a rush on that front. We know that Bibi Netanyahu was going to be removed by his own parliament. He was being investigated for fraud and for financial crimes, and that the Hamas attack couldn't have been better timed for Netanyahu's interest, because Netanyahu could turn the Israeli population against Hamas and conduct a genocide instead of losing office for financial crimes. In the meantime, this rebounds back to America, where the Israel lobby that financed Trump could now tell Trump, you're going to have to shut your mouth and you're going to have to let us do this, because this is now payback on your part for the money that we gave you to allow you to defeat Obama's sock puppet, Biden, and then the sock puppet to the sock puppet, the replacement stand-in for Biden, who they put in office once it was obvious that Biden was completely senile. So we've got a domino effect of cover-ups in England, in Gaza, in America, and now in Canada in this election. And I think we have to do our job as journalists to try to expose this, because this has become, it has truly become too much.
Well, when I say fascist, I don't say that lightly. I think we really are dealing with a criminal elite, you know, organized crime, most definitely bringing, for example, tens of thousands of illegal migrants into Britain. There's lots of legal ones coming in too. That doesn't seem to be enough across the channel. The idea is to just drive down wages, destroy the ability of the trade unions to function to keep wages up, to impoverish the country. It's kind of an attack on the nation as well. Just give you my take on Netanyahu, because I think he actually is coordinating with Charles. Netanyahu is obviously he's Polish. From a very young age, his father brought him up to read Maimonides, and who's a 12th century rabbi in Cairo, who wrote about how the political leadership in Jerusalem was going to bring on the Jewish Messiah. And so this was drilled into Netanyahu as a young man. And so he, I think, sees himself as the man who's going to create so much chaos, John, that it will actually force the issue. In other words, it will force, for example, war. It will force the United States to come in to aid Israel, to save Israel, and some kind of peacemaker, a leader, to try and save the country. And this is a sort of almost like, well, God hasn't done this, and so we're going to actually force the issue. This is very much what Zionism is about, because, you know, the synagogue prayers have been around for 2,500 years. Please bring us back to Jerusalem. But, the religious Jews have wanted God to do that. And it's like these political Zionists have decided, well, we're not waiting for God. We're going to do it at the point of a gun. So what do you think of that?
Well, I think I have to agree with you. I know that Theodor Herzl, who was the founder of the Zionist movement, or the modern founder of the Zionist movement, was actually not religious, didn't believe in God. And that the Zionist movement, I know a little bit about him because he was born and grew up in the suburb of Belgrade, Serbia, in the Zemun suburb, which was at the time of his birth an occupied territory belonging to Austria before World War I. So indeed, these things are connected. It is not a coincidence that Carney is a bankster. It is not a coincidence that Sunak was a bankster. It is not a coincidence that the Israel lobby put Trump into power. There is something taking place now, and we know that there are people like Netanyahu who are served, whose interests are served by war, because in the state of emergency that they've created, he can stay in office. And this is very similar to the situation in the so-called COVID era, a virus which I caught and which I naturally recovered from with the help of what? Well, the banned substance, ivermectin or ivermectin. This is a pulling of the wool over the world's eyes to a degree that I have never seen in my lifetime, and I don't think have had parallels in modern history. I think they realize that their bankster-driven system is collapsing. I think the discussions about whether or not the gold is really in Fort Knox are legitimate questions, and I think that we may be on the eve of a new era. What that era will be, I don't know, but the old era is collapsing.
Well, I can tell you they've got their plans for the new era. So if you have a look at what the accelerationists are up to, it's very, and these are the tech giants. These are the Yuval Noah Harari, the Dark Enlightenment people, Curtis Yarvin, Nick Land, people like that. The plan is, it seems to me, to do Naomi Klein, the shock doctrine, but on the most biggest scale you can possibly imagine. So that is a sort of multiple crisis, with a financial crisis and a war, possibly even a world war, and of course with the Chinese interests and the United States at each other's throats. That could even happen. You know, it's just not beyond the realm of possibility.
There's something I wanted to ask you. Where do you see China in all of this? China is a major productive power, outproducing the United States, producing products cheaper, better, and much, much faster than the United States is able to do. And I think that one of the players in the U.S. equation is a key person who I'd like to ask you your opinion of, and that is Elon Musk. Elon Musk is a person who came out of apartheid South Africa, came to Canada is still a Canadian citizen, and then went to the United States, produced the electric car that was supposed to fight the global warming that the left was worried about, and he is now having his electric cars blown up by terrorists. The United States has declared people who blow up his cars.
I must interrupt you to say something about the electric cars. It seems obvious to me that there is a prediction of a war in the Middle East, which would mean the drying up of much of the world's oil supplies. And so we've got to have some, you know, sort of startup industry that's going to make a fortune out of that. Musk, definitely an accelerationist. He's one of these people. Basically, they are anarcho-capitalists, is what I describe them as. And they see the coming crisis, which they're engineering, as a great opportunity to dominate the outcome. Very much like, so for example, the Versailles conference dominated the outcome of the First World War. And Yalta dominated the outcome of the Second World War. They have their plans, and they know that they can't get these things through in a normal public debate of any sort, but they can when the world is on its knees. And that seems to me to be the object of much of what's going on now. This is what's called accelerationism. And it seems to me to be, you know, the idea is to accelerate the end of the world. And in a way, what you've got is a sort of tug of war, John, I think, between those are on a more moral side that are pushing for justice to come out of this and love to be the outcome, and others who know that this crisis is going to happen, but they have decided that economic slavery and death is going to be the outcome with them in charge. So it's an all or nothing thing, I think, that's coming in our direction that I don't think the world has ever seen anything quite like it.
Neither have I. And I agree with you. I think that we are facing a challenge to everything we know, a challenge to our religious faith, a challenge to our faith in human beings to do the good thing for other human beings, and a challenge to each individual as to whether we're going to stand to the side and let them do it, or whether we're going to personally get involved to try to stop them.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think we need to get together with others of faith. Now, I don't want to proscribe people's faith or prescribe it. But for me, it's important to understand that much of the church is compromised. I mean, from the Vatican, for example, right the way through to the financial priorities of much of the Protestant church. I mean, myself, I'm a bit biased. I'm a nonconformist Quaker, and we came out of the English Civil War as really alternative to the establishment church. But I think, you know, we need to get together with other people of faith to share our concerns, to share our love and care for others that see the things in a similar way to us, and also, of course, to those that don't see things.
I agree with you. You know, I wouldn't call myself a big Bible pounder, but I do believe in God, and I've come to believe in God more as I've grown older and seen things. And I can tell you, back in Serbia, where I was living before I came to Canada now, I've been in Canada almost a year now. I'm heading back to Serbia. But back in Serbia, the Synod of the Serbian Orthodox Church was penetrated by CIA agents as a matter of course and as a priority, because the war empire wants to eliminate the churches as a possible impediment to the wars that they want to conduct. And they put a well-known CIA agent into the synod of our church. We had public debates about it, and there are others in the church who are there for financial reasons, and they are a major force inside the Holy Synod of the Serbian Orthodox Church. And I know that if they're doing it in such a conservative, small church as ours, they must be doing it in the big international churches around the world.
Well, the reason they're doing it is because the church is very much, I mean, politics is the head, if you want, the media and politics, and the church is the heart. They know the power that steering church debate can have. You know, so that, I think, is the main reason they do this. Very interesting to hear that. But I think much of the debate, I mean, for example, we had as our most recent Archbishop of Canterbury here in Britain, we had a guy who was an oil man. You know, suddenly he decides he's going to take up the cloth and he becomes an oil man. And as soon as he started speaking out against the genocide, there's all sorts of problems with his management of child abuse cases, and suddenly he's booted out. So quite clearly, all of these major institutions, there's massive operations by God knows who, by, you know, the secret societies, for goodness sake, against these people, John. Anyway, look, I think we should just maybe finish with a little prayer for the future. And I hope you don't mind. I'd just like to say something along those lines. So, Heavenly Father, we just ask you this Easter that you guide those who are connected to you, your children, to expose the forces of darkness, and also to touch the hearts of those in power, to steer them in the right direction, and to prick their conscience so that they can see your presence, as it's not necessarily an easy thing to do. I think a lot of people don't understand that they have to make the effort to meet God, to find God. And once they do, this can really transform their lives.
I take every word as you've given it and I add my own. Amen.
John Bosnett, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you, Tony. Let's get the word out there.